Chancellor's wife. Of course not. Treya stared, confused. Wanderlei shook his head and waved a hand at her, then pointed back at the closet. She nodded and went back to work. Wanderlei stood and walked to the window. This was it. Gerard was letting him know he planned to...
What's going on back there?
It's a long story.
Tragedy or comedy?
That's yet to be determined.
Why haven't you contacted me?
There were many reasons. The biggest being that Wanderlei was fairly certain Gerard knew full well what had happened. The Kel was playing some form of mind game, a means of flustering his opponent before the battle. He could hear it in his voice. The confidence, the lack of any true outrage. His cordial manner was evidence he knew more than Wanderlei did. Wanderlei obliged him, but without any real effort.
The Aquila launched an overthrow. They tricked me into killing my father, which obliterated my birthright. But I was able to blow the horn, and none of them were brave enough to fight me. I sort of figured it would end there. But that rune we captured ran off with the horn, and someone blew it. I don't suppose you know who that might be?
Wanderlei held his breath.
Actually, I do.
Of course you do, you miserable old snake.
He's here with me now.
Wanderlei pushed out onto the little balcony. The cold winter air gusted into the room, making Treya squawk as the wind ruffled the bed covers. So it wasn't Gerard? Who then? Was it Fidar? One of the younger Myrillith? He decided it didn't matter. He'd still lose. All of them were better at the art.
Who is it?
Nephron of the Instaria. He's sitting right here in the tower. We're having tea. You promised this was going to work, Volhorik shouted at Imari.
I made no promises, she replied. The five of them were locked in the same cell. Thanes had never had much use for prisons, but they did need to store food, since people were prone to steal provisions, especially during hard winters. A lock had been placed on the doors to the cellars, which were dug deep into the ground. The location proved to be an excellent place to store the rebellious members of the Aquila as well, although no one appeared to care if they were preserved or not. Imali was tired of the bickering and finger-pointing, almost all of which was aimed at her. Only Vasek refrained from the popular new pastime. She guessed he didn't indulge because he alone had gone into the endeavor with realistic expectations.
You did, Volhorik insisted. You said as much.
Well, then, you should never have believed me, as no one could promise to deliver such a thing. That was just foolishness on your part. Honestly, Vol, you should know better.
He stood among the crates of onions, glaring at her with an expression that could best be described as a befuddled owl, two big eyes blinking in the dark. Outside, it was daytime, and some few slices of light pierced the slats of the door, just enough for her to recognize the hate on her companions' faces.
I'm only 1,232,
Osla said, in a melodramatic woe-is-me manner, shaking, maybe with the cold. Probably not.
I thought most of my life was still ahead of me.
Macaretta was only 128, Imali reminded her.
But I didn't do anything. That lunatic grey cloak tried to kill the Fane.
So did you. Imali drew her collar tighter around her neck. In summer, the cellar's coolness kept the food fresh. In winter, its temperature was near freezing. How did you think it was going to work out if we failed? Wanderlei will kill us, just as his father executed the grey cloaks. Osler's eyes went wide, as if this notion had never crossed her mind. Imali glared as well.
How stupid are these people? Leaders of their tribes, voices in the council to advise the Fane, and they didn't see this?
But someone challenged him, Nanegal said. We all heard it.
He's Miralith, Vasek said. Only a Miralith will fight him, so the dynamic will be the same. Nothing will change. Knowing that we try to prevent the Miralith tribe from holding power, whoever becomes Fain will also kill us and likely abolish the Aquila, assuming they have even a hint of intelligence.
The lock jiggled, and they all fell silent. The door to the cell drew back, revealing the unmistakable silhouette of Moanderlei. Two guards with lanterns entered ahead of him, brushing the rest of them back among the roots. Osler began to cry.
How are you enjoying your stay? Moanderlei asked.
His voice was far too light, his expression too pleased. Despite her years of bolstering his ego, Imali couldn't imagine Moanderlei being happy at the thought of engaging in mortal combat with any other Miralith. Something had happened.
Turns out, I was smart not to kill you right away. I was so on the brink of it, but it seems you might be useful. If you are, I may be persuaded to let you keep breathing. Interested?
They all nodded, but no one spoke.
Good. I need some questions answered. I've obviously been challenged, but not at the Carfrain. Does the fight have to take place there?
Everyone turned to Volhoric,
who looked down at his feet and shook his head slowly. No. Nothing that I can think of. The Carfrain was actually built by Fenelaus as a stadium for art competitions. It just seemed the best place to hold the fight. Until Lothian dueled Zephyron, horn challenges had never resulted in an actual battle.
Never? Moanderlei asked.
Volhoric looked up.
No. Glyndora named Na'vi Lon her successor before she died.
He looked over at Imali, who nodded.
No one challenged. Geeka was Na'vi Lon's daughter. Everyone accepted her as Fain. My grandfather blew the horn in challenge against her and immediately conceded. He only did that to accommodate the necessary ritual that requires the horn to be blown at least once every 3,000 years. If it's not, the law of Feral wouldn't come into effect. When Geeka was killed by the Durg at the start of the Great War, no one wanted to be Fain. Alon Rist, much to his credit, was brave enough to blow the horn. And when he was killed in battle, once again, no one wanted to be Fain. When your grandmother, Fenelaus, blew the horn, my father, just like his father, blew it too and conceded. So no, the only actual succession by combat was between Lothian and Zephyron.
Moanderlei considered this.
So there are no restrictions on where the fight can be held?
Not that I'm aware of. An arena has to be built, so dry land would help.
An arena?
He spoke the word in shock.
What are we talking about here? A building? A stadium?
Oh, it doesn't need to be much. A circle of a specific size with the proper torches and incense and such.
So nothing super elaborate?
Not really.
May we ask why you want to know?
Imali inquired.
Moanderlei refused to look at her. I have been challenged by Nephron.
He had a hard time keeping a straight face as he said the name.
Apparently, the Instaria want a rematch. I suspect some might have missed the show the first time around, and having heard so much, they want to see it all play out again. I am eager to please them.
How is that possible?
Volhoric asked.
The horn. How did it get to Nephron in time? Isn't he on the other side of the Nidwalden?
I have no idea, Moanderlei said. But Jared says Nephron blew it. According to him, the Galantian was invulnerable during his visit to the tower, proving he was endowed with the protection of Feral. Nephron actually petted the dragons. But he won't come here. He insists on meeting halfway. He settled on the bank of the Nidwalden near Avampartha.
Gerard feels this is great for lots of reasons. We will pull back our troops and dragons to our side of the river and allow the rune to occupy the other. That way, when I win, I can simply destroy them and be done with the war.
What if you lose? Vasek asked, his voice coming from the shadows as always.
Wanderlei leaned to peer around Volhoric, searching for the face behind the question.
Gerard says if that happens, being at Avampartha will be perfect. Nephron hates Myrilith. He'll want to kill us all. Gerard is telling everyone that if Nephron kills me, they should take it as proof he intends to wipe out the Myrilith. He is convincing the artists at the river to be prepared to fight if that happens, dragons and all.
He will break Ferrol's law?
No, Wanderlei grinned. He has a better idea. He will kill the runes, then take Nephron prisoner, lock him away, and rule in his name. Might even torture him a bit. No rules against hurting a fane.
Wanderlei stepped forward and plucked a turnip out of a bag and studied it with a dull expression.
None of that will be necessary, of course. I should have no trouble killing Nephron, but I do want this to be done right. I want no excuses, no failure to perform the proper ritual that later prevents me from taking the throne. So, each of you will be coming to the challenge to guarantee that everything is done properly. If everything goes right, you do your part and I get the throne, then I let you go. There won't be any Aquila anymore, but you won't be dead either. And you, Imali, he finally faced her, you will be the one to crown me when I win.
Imali felt her heart sink and her great-grandmother shift in her grave.
All of it was a lie. The moment Wanderlei was properly seated on the throne, he would execute every member of the Aquila, including Vidar, if he could find him. This was a promise he made to himself as he walked through the snow back to the palace.
I wonder how Imali will like being lied to.
On his way, Wanderlei slipped through the garden and paused at the door. It was closed again, sealed shut, and once more no one could open it. Wanderlei turned to look at the nearest bench, the one eternally occupied by the enigma who called himself Trilos. The bench was vacant, the garden empty. Wanderlei pondered this for some time. Did Trilos go in? Is he still inside?
Normally, Wanderlei hated his encounters with the bench warmer, but just then, Wanderlei realized he was interested in what was behind the door, in how the horn might have gotten to Nephron, and in several other things. But like his bedroom, Wanderlei's world was changing, emptying of all the old things he used to know, the good and the bad.
When he returned to his room, Treya was still there. His chambers were packed up and cleaned, but she remained seated on the stripped-down bed.
You're back,
she said brightly, and stood up. She was smiling. Wanderlei couldn't remember her ever doing that before. At least, not like this.
You're finished in here. That's good. We need to pack up. We are heading to Avampartha in the morning.
Treya nodded.
I'll get you packed. But there was that one thing I wanted to discuss with you.
What's that?
In the wake of all the excitement, and the relief that all he needed to do was kill an Instaria, he found himself exhausted and wanted to lie down.
He'd been having trouble sleeping, but he didn't think that would be a problem anymore. I could take a nice nap. The secret, Treya said, the one your father ordered me to never speak to you about.
Oh, right. What was that? He asked, then yawned.
I was nursemaid to your brother, Peridian. You see, his mother, Olyona, died giving birth, so I was brought in. At the time, I was very young, only a few hundred years old. Your father and I raised Peridian, and he turned out to be a fine son, a great artist. He taught both Grindel and Arion.
Yes, I've heard.
Wanderlei didn't enjoy hearing how great his older brother had been. He never had. Now that Wanderlei was about to become Thane, listening to the achievements of Peridian felt disrespectful at best.
When he died...
How did he die?
Wanderlei asked.
I never heard.
An accident, Treya said. Something Peridian was trying at the academy one night. That's what Grindel said. The two were the only ones there at the time. Something to do with the art, I suspect. But I'm not an artist, am I? Anyway, when Peridian died, it devastated your father. Didn't do me any good either.
Is this the secret my father forbade you from telling me?
Treya shook her head.
No.
Getting to that any time soon?
Treya looked embarrassed and nodded.
Because Peridian was dead, your father felt he needed another heir. But he didn't want all the headaches that came with marriage. I was there, relatively young, and being a Gwaedri, I was no threat. He could discard me without repercussions. He knew I would never protest, never cause a fuss.
Her voice grew softer and quieter.
When you were born, he planned to send me away, usher me off to some small distant village. Make me disappear. I pleaded with him. I begged to be part of your life. I knew it would kill me to never see you, never hold you. I wanted to guide your first steps, hear your first words.
Treya bowed her head.
I think our history raising Peridian together softened his heart, and he granted me this favor. He said I could be your nursemaid, just as I had been with Peridian, but under the condition that I never tell anyone, especially not you.
She stared at him then. Treya seemed to be waiting for something, but Wanderlei had no idea what.
So, are you going to tell me this big secret or not?
Treya blinked in surprise. Wanderlei, I'm your mother.
While this wasn't the best of jokes, Wanderlei laughed anyway. The build-up was what did it. Treya really sold the backstory.
I'm not joking. I am your mother.
The deadpan look on her face was too much. Thank you, Treya. I needed that. Things have been so serious around...
One, I'm serious. You are my son.
Wanderlei stared, confused. Selling a joke was one thing, but this was...
She's serious? Treya, you're Gwaedri.
I'm Myrilith. Of course you're not my mother. Don't be absurd.
She reached out and put a hand on his arm.
But I am. Look into my eyes. You'll see. I'm telling the truth.
Wanderlei couldn't believe her insolence. This insane insistence that they were elated, and then her touching him as if she had a right. He pushed her away.
You know, I wouldn't have thought it possible. Not you, too.
He shook his head in disgust.
Everyone lies to me. Himali, Fulhoric, they all pretend to be someone they're not. You learn I'm going to be Thane, discover that all I have to do is kill an Instaria, and here you are, claiming to be my long-lost mother. Isn't that convenient? Yesterday you were a Gwaedri palace servant, but today you're the mother of the Thane. You disgust me.
Wanderlei stood up.
Don't bother packing. You won't be coming to Avempartha. I never want to see you again.
With those words, Wanderlei left his chambers, along with the whole world as he'd once known it, and he did so for the last time.
Chapter 25. Mission from God. For motivation, nothing beats having a god take a personal interest in your work.
the Book of Brynn. Brynn lay on her side, staring at the bed across from her. There was a sag, a hollow depression in the straw mattress, exactly the size of Padera. It wasn't large. The cavity could have been made by a sizable dog. Somehow, Brynn remembered Padera as bigger. She'd certainly played a larger role in Brynn's life, in everyone's life. Hanging in a net bag on the wall was an assortment of spices Padera had received from Grigor. She'd stopped using them after the giant died, but kept them in that bag with all her other cherished items. On the floor was the bolt of fabric for Tressa's dress. As a surprise, the garment was going to have pleats. Brynn had planned to make that dress ridiculously beautiful, not just with pleats, but with buttons, too, and a pocket. People would marvel at Tressa, instead of sneering in her direction. Brynn started crying. She'd pulled her blanket up to her cheeks because the tent was cold that morning. Now she used the corners to wipe her eyes. More tears came. She wiped again. Didn't help. Brynn just gave up then and, burying her face in the cloth, sobbed. Brynn? A shadow appeared outside. Brynn, are you awake?
Yes.
Her voice was wispy, ragged from the weeping. The flap drew back. More sunlight entered, and Persephone rushed in with it.
I was so scared, Persephone said, and hugged the girl tightly.
Then, as if realizing she might be hurting Brynn, Persephone loosened her hold.
Malcolm told me you died, but might come back. It was so hard to believe.
Brynn wanted to hug back, but her arms were too weak to perform a good squeeze. Neither said anything for some time. Then Persephone drew away, wiped her eyes, and sat opposite Brynn on Padera's bed so she could look her over. Reaching across the narrow gap, she took Brynn's hands, warming them in hers.
How are you feeling? Like I've been dead for a week.
The answer felt stupid coming out of her mouth, but it was the truth. After delivering the horn, Brynn had passed out. She had no recollection of how she got to her tent. She woke up exhausted, noticed it was morning, and realized the effects of Muriel's meal had long since worn off. She felt horrible. Everything ached, except her head, which throbbed, and her stomach, which both ached and throbbed. It also twisted with a simmering nausea. Food and drink were at the side of her bed. She forced herself to nibble and then fell back to sleep. When she woke up again, it was dark. More food had been delivered, and again she ate and drank what she could and fell asleep once more.
How long have I been here? How many days have I been sleeping?
Just a few. I've visited you often, but nothing excessive. Persephone forced a smile. Only about once every hour. You're always asleep, and I didn't want to wake you. I usually just sat over here and listened to you breathe.
It made me feel better. I don't know about you.
Persephone's face was coated in concern as she rubbed the back of Brynn's hand in a slow, circular pattern. She didn't say anything, waiting for Brynn, expecting her to explain all that had happened and where the others were. Brynn was a keeper, after all. That was her job. Only Brynn didn't want to tell that story. Not now. Not yet. It hurt too much, and she was already in such pain. As if understanding this, Persephone didn't ask.
You still look tired.
She reached up and brushed Brynn's cheek.
I am.
Persephone nodded.
You should rest then. We can talk another time. Nephron will be fighting Mandalay in a few days near Avampartha. We'll have to be leaving soon, but before I go, I wanted you to know that your mother and father would be so very proud of you, Brynn, of all that you've done for us, of all that you sacrificed. They are, Brynn said. And my mother thinks you are doing a wonderful job as Keenig.
Persephone bit her lip and sucked in an uneven breath. Her eyes grew teary as she nodded.
You saw her. You saw Sarah and Delwyn.
Yes, Bryn smiled. I saw everyone, even Padera and Darby too. I always wondered about dogs, where they went.
I guess maybe if someone loves you enough.
Bryn felt the tears rising again.
What about... Yes, Wraith was there. He wants you to know that he understands why you picked Nefren. And he's not upset. He still loves you. And he waits for you.
He... Persephone silenced her with a squeeze of her hand. She nodded, wiped away a tear, and didn't say anything for a long time. Then she said,
I'm so sorry, Bryn.
That was all it took. She began crying again. Persephone shifted beds. She hugged Bryn, pulling her tight.
It's okay. It's okay,
she repeated, as if willing it to be so. Bryn dropped her head onto Persephone's shoulder, her brow pressed against the older woman's neck.
You did it, Bryn.
Persephone rocked forward and back, taking Bryn with her, holding her like a child who'd just woken from a nightmare.
You saved us. You saved them. You saved everyone.
Bryn lifted her head.
Not everyone.
Persephone cupped Bryn's face, lifted it, and looked into her eyes.
Don't do that. I know what it's like to lose people. I know how it feels when you believe it's your fault. It can eat you up from the inside. Don't let it. You're so young. You still have so much life to live. Don't give in to the grief. You have to go on.
Bryn didn't realize she was shaking her head until Persephone took a firmer grip and stopped her.
You have to, Bryn. You must.
I don't want to.
It's not about want. Do you think I wanted to keep eating after Marn died? Or continue to breathe after Reglan? And when Wraith...
Her voice broke. She let go of Bryn's face and turned away.
It's not about want. Some things you just have to do. Some things you need to do because you can and others can't. Do you understand?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Good.
She kissed Bryn, hugged her one more time, then stood up.
Wait,
Bryn said, then paused in thought, recalling her conversation with Moya.
What good will come from telling her now? She's married to Nefren. They have a child.
While all that was true, the more important point was that Nefren had blown the horn, and the fate of all runes rested in his ability to win against Mwandalay. Not to mention that it was what Malcolm wanted. He wouldn't have put them through all they endured if it weren't so important.
What benefit will come from revealing his treachery? If I tell her the truth, Persephone will do what she always does. She'll sacrifice herself for her people. She'll do nothing, say nothing. But late at night she'll torment herself with the ugly truth that she married a ruthless murderer who thought nothing of starting a war to serve himself. Is that what I want to give her?
If Bryn kept quiet and Nefren were to win the challenge, that day could be bright. Persephone could receive the reward she deserved. The sacrifices would be balanced against the promise of the future.
That the world would be a better place.
If Bryn told the truth, she'd have to live in silence knowing that her husband had deceived her, that the father of her child was to blame for thousands of deaths,
that she had...
What is it, Bryn?
Persephone asked.
Nothing.
Bryn lay on her bed, listening to the sounds of those preparing to travel as they went about the tasks of breaking down and packing up. The camp had been in place for years, and travel in winter was miserable. More than one person complained, but mostly to themselves. Bryn could hear them through the canvas, grumbling and cursing their misfortune.
They had no idea what real hardship was, or how lucky they were.
None of them knew the price that had been paid for the luxury of their inconvenience.
They will.
Bryn looked over at the stack of pages.
I can do that much for them.
The flap of her tent lifted. May I come in? Malcolm asked, as he did so anyway. He bent low to get his tall, lanky frame under the roof of the tent.
He smiled at her as he moved in a crouch to sit on Padera's bed, just as Persephone had. Malcolm let his hands run over the surface of Padera's bed, dipping down into the depression the old woman had left.
She seemed bigger than this.
She gave me your message.
Yes, I know. I can't see into Pyre, but looking into the swamp of Earth is an easy task.
She still hates you.
A lot of people do. But you know that now, right? You know everything. That's why I sent you. I needed you to know the truth, warts and all. Bryn nodded and watched as Malcolm crossed his long legs and folded his hands in his lap. He looked clumsy and not at all godlike.
Funny, the Frey always looked like gods, and Grindel acted like one. But they weren't. Malcolm looks like the kind of awkward man whom people ignore. The dull sort that is never noticed, never appreciated. Tressa was right, though. Malcolm is a god. And with the world as his mother, the sky as his father, and immortality granted from Aluria's gift, he might be the only true god. Unfortunately, he's the god of evil.
Is it true? She asked.
Malcolm raised his brows. You'll have to be more specific.
That you're evil?
Malcolm smiled. Evil is an odd word. Somewhat useless, really. It means different things to different people, doesn't it? If you're asking, did I do many terrible things, then yes, I did. I would say I hold the record for that achievement. But am I evil? I suppose that's for others to decide. People like you.
You sent all of us to our deaths without so much as a warning. You had Tressa lie to us so we didn't even know what we were getting into.
Yes, I did. I've deceived a great many people.
Why did you do it?
Because it was what was necessary. If there had been a better option, I would have chosen it. There wasn't.
I don't... Bryn shook her head. I don't know what to make of you. Are you trying to fix the world? Elan says you are, but Muriel says you aren't. Who is right?
Again he smiled, once more looking like the same old friendly Malcolm, the one she remembered sitting on the floor of Roan's home, chatting about how Frey, Durg, and runes were all related.
I can't answer that question. Well, I could, but we've already established that I'm not to be trusted, so my answer would be pointless. All I can say is this. You've spoken to my enemies, and the very few people who might still believe in me. I have no idea what they told you, but words can be lies. So I'll ask you to judge me on my actions. Granted, up to this point, it's difficult to know all the things I've done. But you can see where we are now. And if you think about it, you'll see that I've been steering us to this point. The world is about to change. And if it's going to be for the better, you should aid me. That's why I sent you. To grant you the unvarnished knowledge necessary to decide. Bryn nodded. Well then, on to other matters. Can I assume you no longer have my key?
Bryn sucked in a breath. She closed her eyes with all the expectations of a criminal ready to be executed. Then she confessed.
I left it in a safe place in Pyre.
Malcolm frowned.
That's... probably not a very...
It's only temporary. I'm hoping the others will be able to get out. Even if they can't, it will be given to Muriel.
Malcolm tilted his head to the right, and then to the left, considering the implications. When he didn't say more, Bryn spoke up.
I told her that you're trying to fix things.
Let me guess. It had no effect. She still hates me.
Bryn frowned, and with a sudden, unexpected fit of bravery and self-righteousness said,
You need to fix that.
Yes.
Malcolm displayed a sort of smile, a curious,
amused expression.
You have learned a lot. What's more, you've become quick to advise.
Bryn flushed. Malcolm didn't look like Farrell or Drone. He didn't speak with a booming voice, more of a quiet tone, but his words carried a similar weight.
Sorry, she said.
You should know by now. That's one sentiment no one need ever express to me. He nodded then. And you're right. And I am working on it.
Trust is a good first step, don't you think?
He didn't appear to share her enthusiasm, but neither did he strike her dead. Bryn took this as a good sign. She was still trying to wrap her head around the idea that this unassuming man before her had sort of fought the sky and kind of won. He didn't look anything like how Elan had depicted him, wearing a crown and a shimmering robe that changed colors. The notion that he had once ruled the world and made it tremble seemed so odd. And before that, what was it like?
What do you mean?
In the beginning. Before, you know, before everything went bad.
Malcolm looked at the floor. He appeared sad for a moment. Then the smile returned.
It was wonderful. Not at all like now. The world was, well, like bread, fresh out of an oven. You know what I mean. The smell fills the air and makes everything wonderful somehow. And it tastes so good when it's warm and soft.
Fact is, all you've ever known is hard, week-old, moldy crust. Back then, colors were different, the light brighter. Everything was just, well, more, I guess.
It's hard to explain. Everyone who had ever been was here. Not one had died. The world was massive, unexplored, and more people arrived every day. New friends, new loves, and an endless universe was our playground. Instead of fear, regret, and hate, we had only joy, love, and happiness.
No wonder they hate you, Bryn said.
Malcolm's brows rose, and Bryn's hands flashed to her mouth as if to retrieve the words and push them back in.
No, no, you're right. It's true. I ruined all that, and that's why I'm here, why I've come to visit. I have one last task for you, a very, very important job.
It doesn't involve running, does it? Because I can't even walk. If I could, I'd be...
Malcolm raised a hand to stop her.
No, but you do need to get up. I've arranged a wagon for you. A nice one with wooden sides and a fringed canopy. There's a bed filled with thick blankets. It will take you days to get to Avampartha, but while you are traveling, I need you to finish this.
He placed a hand on the stack.
You need to write down everything you learned in Pyre.
I plan to. I will. But as soon as I'm better, I need to go.
No, he said firmly. This has to be done now.
You mean now?
Yes. And don't worry about your supplies. You'll have all the ink and parchment you require.
I don't understand.
This is why you went, Bryn. To be honest, writing what you learned is even more important than retrieving the horn. Stopping the war was crucial, of course. Nefrin will become the first emperor of those born of Mara and the children of Farrell. Then he'll make an alliance with Drome's children. But that's only a start. Your book will do the rest.
It was a lovely sentiment, but Bryn couldn't follow the logic.
How?
With it, you will teach the world a new language. From your book, all races will learn to read and write. This will give them a common tongue again, allowing them to communicate with one another as they once did. And in reading your story, they will learn that they are all one people, born of the same five seeds, of the same mother and father. This will open the door for reunification. Bryn, I sent you through Pyre so you could see the truth for yourself.
I sent you because no one can ever doubt your words. My words, on the other hand... He shook his head and snorted. No one will ever believe me. No one will listen. And with good cause. I wouldn't believe me either. But you, your words are untainted. I sent you into Pyre because you're flawless. Perfect.
I'm not, she said, feeling the pain return. How can you even say that? For example, look at how disgusting and messy this tent is.
She glared at him as her lower lip began to quiver.
I've been mean to people too. I was judgmental. For years, I despised Tressa. And I didn't even help my Uncle Gelston after he was struck by lightning.
Tears came up and spilled.
And Tesh and Roan, Gifford, Moya, Rain and Tressa.
She wiped her cheeks.
I left them behind. I'm not perfect, Malcolm. Not at all.
You left the key for them. You did so while knowing I would want it back. You willingly angered the god of evil, the creator of murder, deceit, and war, and you didn't even hide the fact. You didn't try to lie to save yourself.
That doesn't sound like much of a character flaw. I still abandoned them, and Tesh wouldn't even have died if it weren't for me.
She stared at the blanket on her bed, her hands spread out, palms down, sliding back and forth, smoothing it. Okay. Malcolm shrugged. Have it your way. You aren't perfect, but you're close. That actually helps. People are suspicious of those who have no flaws. Knowing you've made mistakes will make it easier for people to believe your writings. Through your words, they will learn to join and work together. But you really do need to hurry. Bryn paused in her efforts to wipe out the wrinkles.
Why?
Because my brother is back on Alan. I can't see him any more than I can see into Pyre, but I can witness the effects of his actions. I don't want all that I've sewn up to unravel. He'll follow behind me, tearing my seams apart. He knows about you, doesn't he? She nodded.
We've met.
And I fear you will again. It's only a matter of time.
He chuckled.
Time. It's endless, yet its rate of passing is never constant. And it's something, believe it or not, I fear I need more of. Malcolm looked mournful as he got up and went toward the entrance. Before he could leave, Bryn said,
Elan told me, if anyone could fix the world, it was you.
Malcolm pulled back the tent flap, letting the sunlight in. He turned back and said, perhaps she has too much faith in me.
She's not the only one. I believe in you too.
Malcolm looked skeptical. Even after all you've learned? How can you, Bryn? I created evil and invented the lie. Until recently, everything you knew about me was a fabrication. I used you and everyone else. It wasn't Nefren who murdered all those people for his own selfish means. He didn't start this war. I put spark to that flame. I sacrificed Wraith, Arion, the entire Dorian clan, all the people of Nadak, and so much more than you could ever know.
Everyone falls. We all have things that we regret. No one is perfect. You know that now. But you didn't when you were Rex Ubalin. Your mother is right. You've changed. And I think that your trying has to count for something, doesn't it?
Perhaps. But the real question is, will it be enough? And only time will tell. Then his gaze moved to the stack. You might want to take measures to protect that. I fear my brother will not abide anything I had a hand in creating. Be careful, Bryn. Be very careful.
Chapter 26 The Man in the Mirror.
Gifford is like a pearl inside an oyster. From the exterior, no one would ever assume such a treasure lay inside. The Book of Bryn.
Didn't seem as wide before, Gifford said as he stood at the broken edge of the stone bridge and stared across at Nifril. They had no trouble seeing the far side. Even if the Queen's manufactured grey sky weren't lighting the world, the combined shine of Roan and Gifford would have done just fine. After reaching the top of the pillar, the two were once more clad in Albrecht Berling's armour. Roan, who had never felt comfortable in it, stripped off the priceless suit. Gifford did the same, and they were surprised that removing the Belgric-Lungrian armour hadn't put a dent in the light they emitted. The gap wasn't wide. Gifford could throw a rock across the missing section of bridge. Beyond the gap lay the slate-grey plain, the worn-out battlefield polished and stained dark with the non-existent blood of uncounted conflicts. After all the time they had spent in the abyss, seeing the plain of Kilcorth seemed like waving to an old friend.
Has it been years? It certainly feels like it.
Even the Queen's White Tower, which rose a short way to the left, didn't hold the same horror it once had. After facing oblivion in the unending dark, everything else was a good deal more pleasant. And they didn't have the key anymore. Nothing to protect, no rush, nothing to worry about, except how to cross the gap. Unless they found a way, the two would spend eternity on that tiny tongue of stone.
Don't suppose you have any ideas, do you? He asked, while glancing over his shoulder at Roan.
She gave him a withering look as she continued her pacing between the mirrored door and the severed end of the bridge. She was still fuming for not having realized they should have climbed the other cliff. Just stupid. Just so stupid, she muttered.
She'd been saying that for a while. Did you even know the bridge was broken? He asked. I was nearly hit by the pieces, but you weren't there.
She didn't answer, just scowled as if Gifford was taking the wrong side in an argument with a hated enemy.
Sorry.
He held up his hands, then sighed.
We're going to have to go back down, aren't we?
Roan groaned.
It might be fun, you know.
She didn't appear to know anything of the sort, as she continued to frown.
I mean, this time we're armed with the knowledge that we won't splat and that we can climb back out.
He smiled at her.
So it could be like diving. People enjoy diving.
Gifford got to his hands and feet and peered over the edge, looking again for signs of Tesh and Tressa and wondering if he could see the Typhons. That would be the only real issue. Falling on them. He had no clear idea what a Typhon was, and didn't feel the slightest need to find out. He and Roan would need to wait a good long time to ensure the things had moved away.
But how long is long enough? And how can I keep track?
Gifford couldn't see the Typhons, and there was still no sign of Tressa or Tesh.
Well, if it helps, I never would have gotten this far without you, he smiled.
Roan's eyes narrowed, and she began shaking her head.
How could that possibly help? How?
Her brow wrinkled, lower lip riding up. Roan started making a noise in the back of her throat, the prelude to a scream. Instead, she punched both of her thighs with her fists and resumed her pacing.
There's got to be a way. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Roan shoved a lock of hair into her mouth and chewed it as she passed by in her eternal walk. Then she halted. She didn't move for a second, just stopped and stared, but only into the distance, not at anything in particular. Gifford knew that when Roan was thinking, she could walk right into a wall and never notice. Whatever she was seeing, it wasn't the bridge or the abyss. He often speculated on what she did see. Crimbles, perhaps, or the gods pantomiming answers to her questions.
You can do it, she said.
Do what, Roan? We've discussed this before, remember? How I can't actually hear your thoughts?
She pivoted and showed him her frustrated face.
You have to give me a hint at least.
Okay. The mirror! The mirror! She pointed frantically. The door to Allison!
What about it?
You can go through.
Gifford shook his head. We don't have the key.
You don't need the key, she said, her hair falling out of her mouth as she spoke.
Roan, I saw you push on it. You knocked, put your nose to the glass.
We can't get through without the key. That's not what I said, Roan huffed. I said you don't need the key. You're the hero of Granford.
Gifford smirked and folded his arms. I'm not a hero.
She fixed him with one of her impatient glares. She had an assortment. This was the one accompanied with squeezing fists of frustration. You thought you were going to your death. We all thought you were going to die. Even Padera did. You did, too, didn't you?
He shrugged. Yeah, sure. But that doesn't mean...
It does! Roan came to him, knelt down, and took one of his hands. She threaded her fingers into his, as she loved to do. She had once told him that the way their fingers fit, the way they wove, was practical evidence of a universal truth. It demonstrated that they were meant to be together. The first time she told him this, he foolishly pointed out the obvious, that everyone's fingers fit together. He remembered how she had smiled and nodded with profound understanding.
Exactly, she'd said. No one in all of Alan Rist would have dared do what you did that night. Not Nephron and not any of the Galentians. And everyone says they're heroes, but they aren't. Not really. But you are. You risked everything. You, who'd never used a sword or spear before, or sat on a horse. You put on armor and alone rode into the face of the Frey army. And for what? Glory?
No, Gifford said, surprised she could even say that.
She laughed softly. The sound was music. Ice water on a sweltering day. A warm blanket on a cold night. He loved that laugh.
I know, she said, her eyes full of pride. You never once thought of yourself. And when Tressa declared she would travel through Pyre, you were the first to volunteer to die with her. Even if it meant leaving me, you couldn't let her die alone. And when I couldn't make it out of the abyss, you stayed to keep me company. Never even tried to leave. You bravely gave of yourself. More important, you don't even see the miracle in that. I honestly suspect you think everyone is that way. But they aren't. Almost no one is. Gifford, you are a hero. A real hero. And I think that means that door is open to you.
Gifford looked across the remaining bridge at the mirror. Even at that distance, he could see himself in it. A shimmering light.
Not without you.
Roan's brows went up.
Did you think I was asking you to leave me behind?
Well, then I guess I don't understand.
It's just like the Battle of Granford.
Still not seeing the path you're walking, Roan.
She rolled her eyes, huffing through her nose again.
You need to go get help.
Get help? How can I... We don't know what's over there. And anyway, if I go through, I won't be able to come back. I mean, if I belong over there, Roan, I won't be able to come back here without the key.
Doesn't apply to you, she said, with that misty-eyed look of hers. This was the same reverent stare she used to beam at him whenever he gave her cups or that amphora. It proclaimed he was something he wasn't.
Gifford would have thought that she would have lost that expression of awe years ago, around the same time she saw him roll out of bed. Something that, with his bad leg and twisted back, he literally did. And oftentimes hit the ground in the process. But there she was, as entranced as ever.
What do you mean?
You put your hand through the door going back into Rell.
almost got pulled back through. You didn't have the key. Tressa did, and she was nowhere near you. The doorway was locked. Had to be. Otherwise, Drome's minions would have come through. But your arm went right in. It passed back. So I have a theory. Maybe everyone can go backward through Pyre, and the key is only needed to go forward. Or maybe only you can do it. Doesn't matter. You have the ability to move through doors without the key. A theory. She fixed him with a smirk. He knew this look too, but Rhone didn't own that expression. He'd seen Moya display the same twisted smile when anyone suggested she couldn't hit a mark with an arrow, or when someone asked Bryn if she could recall, well, anything. Okay, so your theories usually work, but not always. This one will. She wasn't lying. Rhone didn't lie, but she was exuding more confidence than she should.
Really? Because you don't look confident. To be honest, you look terrified.
I'm certain you will be able to come back, she told him. I'm just not positive you'll want to.
What are you talking about?
A light flickered. This was hard for her. She was being brave. Through that door is paradise. If you go there, you'll want to stay. It'll make you forget all about me.
No, it won't, he said.
She nodded, but her light dimmed again.
I will come back, Rhone. This,
he touched her cheek, this right here is paradise. She offered him an embarrassed smile, then nodded. I'll wait for you. He stood up, and together they walked hand in hand to the mirror. Their reflection was strange. While Rhone was just as magnificent as ever, the man beside her, the one holding her hand, made him jealous. Tall, handsome, confident. Everything he wasn't. Pyre had a strange way of twisting the view of things.
I look so different, he said.
Rhone's face twisted up, befuddled. She peered into the mirror, then over at Gifford.
I don't understand. You look the way you always do.
He laughed.
The guy in there is gorgeous and dashing.
Rhone nodded.
Really?
He laughed and straightened himself up, striking a dramatic, heroic pose.
So, this is how I appear to you. This is how you see me in Pyre.
Puzzlement once more filled Rhone's face.
No, that's how you've always looked.
Tears welled up in his eyes as Gifford pulled her to him and kissed her. She had no body, but he felt her warmth, and those lips, soft, moist, quivering. Their faces slid past each other, tear-slicked cheeks pressing as he hugged her as tightly as he could.
I love you so much, Rhone. And so help me, so help everyone, I will be back.
Then Gifford passed through his own reflection into a world of light, music, and colour. Rhone watched Gifford go, saw him pass through. Once he was gone, she was left with only her own reflection in the mirror. Some stranger she'd never known glared back at her through the glass. The stranger looked sick and terrified. Turning away, she surveyed her tiny realm. Nothing but a broken bridge and the little cave with the door.
I wonder how long I'll be here. This is the first time I've been completely alone since I killed Ivar.
After Ivar's death, Padera had arranged for Moya to move in with Rhone, and the old woman was a frequent visitor. The two took turns watching Rhone, who had expected to be executed or severely punished at the very least. Any idiot had to realize she'd killed her owner. Instead, Padera taught her how to cook, and Moya taught her how to live. Yet it was Bryn who gave her the greatest gift, admiration. Rhone couldn't understand it at first. The girl visited frequently, asking all sorts of questions. Roan was convinced Bryn was after evidence to prove Roan had killed Ivor, only she acted so oddly. She would arrive all excited, sometimes bringing little gifts, things she'd found. Bryn would ask what the name of a colored stone was, as if Roan knew everything. And then she realized that was exactly what Bryn thought. The girl wasn't looking for evidence. Bryn was in awe. No one had ever looked up to Roan. But Bryn did. Realizing this, Roan discovered that she hated herself a little less afterward. Bryn had managed to open the door that Moya and Padera had struggled to bust down. The door to a prison that Roan herself had built. Now here she was again, alone in the dark. She had shed all her old ghosts and left them below, but she quickly discovered new ones. She was scared that Gifford wouldn't come back, and also frightened that he would. On the other side of that mirror was paradise, some sort of wonder world that she couldn't begin to imagine. Through that glass was the reward that Gifford deserved. Inside was his happiness, but she wasn't allowed in. Roan wanted Gifford to have everything, but she also wanted Gifford. Needed him. Padera had given her wisdom, Moya courage, and Bryn confidence. But Gifford had given her love. She could deal with being stupid, scared, and insecure, but she couldn't go without love. Gifford was the one who had truly saved her. He was the one true thing, the unbending, unmoving, unbreakable hero of her life. And Roan resolved in her heart that she would wait by that door forever. Wait for Gifford. And hope, for his sake, he never returned.
Roan!
She spun. There was no one there. No one near her. The voice came from far away. Tesh? Tressa? It didn't sound like them. And it hadn't come from below.
Roan! Over here!
Are you sure that's Roan?
Moya asked. All she could reliably see was the light and a figure within it.
That light is so bright.
I'm telling you, it's Roan.
Tekchin said, as they stood on the end of the broken bridge, peering out across the dark gulf.
You also told me you were too weak to stand, remember?
I think it's Roan too,
Rain said, as he continued to fidget with the sword. They had all rushed out of Midian's castle, and the dwarf was still having trouble with his blade. The pommel of Lorillion kept hitting the handle of his axe whenever he took a step. He had clinked all the way there.
That was hours ago,
Tekchin said with a mischievous smile.
I'm feeling much better now.
Moya frowned at him.
So you're saying you made this perfect recovery in a few hours after being near death for who knows how long?
She put a hand on her hip.
And how exactly are you telling time, my sweet? Besides, Beatrice already spilled the beans. I know what the two of you have been up to, and don't try denying it.
Tekchin let the battle die and returned to the topic at hand. He pointed at the distant light and said,
It's her, I'm telling you.
Then why is she so bright, and why doesn't she answer?
Moya held her bow, Audrey, above her head and waved it.
Roan!
The figure stood up.
Moya?
Roan called back.
Tekchin grinned. Mystery solved.
One of them, Moya said. Why I love you is still up for debate, along with...
She clapped her sides in frustration as she glared at the jagged tongue of stone that had once been a bridge.
How are we going to get over to her? How is she going to get over to us?
Moya looked down into the endless dark.
How did she get up there to begin with?
Didn't Beatrice tell you?
Rain asked.
No,
Moya said, a bit of anger slipping into her tone.
Did she tell you?
The dwarf shook his head.
All she ever tells me is how great I am. Makes me homesick for Frost and Flood, who say they can never understand how me mother didn't drown me the first time she saw me face.
Nice friends you got there.
I'm guessing Beatrice assumed you knew there was no bridge.
Tekchin inched his way out onto the tongue like a cat on a wind-whipped branch.
You two were here when it exploded, right?
We all were.
Yeah, but I was in pieces at the time. This is the first I've seen it.
Rone,
Moya shouted.
Do you know how to get across?
Working on it. Sort of.
Rone's voice was a chickadee-sized tweet, nearly lost to the overwhelming silence that blew up from the deep.
What is she doing, do you think? Tekchin asked.
Who knows? It's Rone.
The bigger question is, where are the others?
Moya scanned the far side and down the length of the pillar as far as she could see. The only one visible was Rone. Beatrice had gathered up Tekchin, Moya and Rain and shoved them out the door into the cold grey of the endless Nifril night. She gave her usual, cryptically confusing directions. Rather than telling them to run after Brynn, the little princess sent them the opposite way.
You need to go to the bridge first, and hurry, you're running out of time. The Queen is asking questions. It won't be long before she decides to come out and investigate for herself.
But if we have to hurry after Brynn, why do we need to...
It will all make sense. Just go. It's not making sense,
Moya muttered to herself. Stupid little princess. She whirled on Rain.
Can you do something? Can you build a bridge?
Rain looked up at her, startled.
I dig, he said,
then pointed out at the nothing that lay between them and Rone. Moya squinted across at Rone. She wasn't even moving. As far as Moya could tell, her friend was just standing there. That's when Moya heard the drum, a pounding in the distance off to her right. Soon, this was followed by a horn. The sounds came from the White Tower of Feral.
Gifford,
a woman's voice said. Long hair, bright smile, the woman stood before him in a beautiful gown, her arms held out in invitation. Gifford wasn't sure what to do, and his hesitation extinguished the woman's smile. Then her eyes clouded as tears invaded that once happy face.
He doesn't know me.
Coming up behind her, a man placed his hands on the woman's shoulders, giving her a slight squeeze of sympathy. He was familiar, a face out of the past, but different, so young.
Father?
Gifford asked. The man nodded, then looked at the woman he held before him, the first person Gifford had seen upon entering Allison.
That should have been my first clue.
His mouth opened, but not to say anything. It just hung agape as he stared at her in wonder. Gifford had always wondered what she had looked like. As a child, he had fashioned her face out of the best bits and pieces he found in others, the most beautiful, the most kind. That was the memory he carried, the timeless illusion of a goddess that he'd invented. The woman before him looked nothing like he had imagined. This person was young, younger than Rone, younger than himself, not much more than a child, and so small, so tiny and delicate, like a songbird. There were freckles on her cheeks. Gifford had never once imagined freckles. He thought of them as imperfections, and this mother could have none. Her hair was wavy, her face thin, even a bit gaunt. Her front two teeth were a smidge too large, a small mouth drawing too much attention to them. She could have been Brynn's younger sister, or Persephone's daughter, but she wasn't. Her eyes brimmed with tears as she watched him. In that gaze, he saw pain, fear, regret, longing, and love. A tear slipped down, first one cheek,
and then the other.
Mother? He said.
Her shaking hands went to her mouth as more tears spilled. All she could do was nod in reply. Nod and cry. Gifford had never felt more awkward, never more crippled. He staggered forward and reached out. She extended a hand toward him, and for the first time, Gifford touched his mother. Their fingers clasped, and she drew him to her. She was so small, but her arms engulfed him, her tiny body pressed tight.
Gifford, Gifford, Gifford,
she repeated in a whispered chant broken by sobs.
I've waited so long to hold you. I'm so sorry I wasn't there. I wish you didn't have to go through so much all alone.
Her voice failed. Gifford's father put a hand on his shoulder, making a folded lip face as he, too, cried, while nodding over and over, agreeing to a million unsaid truths.
I knew you'd do it, my boy. Never had a doubt. Not ever. I'm married, he told them. She's wonderful, and she's waiting for me. Right now, Roan is probably torturing herself, thinking I'll never return. So I have to go. We know. Good, but the bridge is gone. That's why I'm here. We need help. Is there anything you can do?
His parents smiled at each other in pride, as if he'd just taken his first step.
You don't need our help, my love. I heard about your ride and how you started the fire at Perdif with just the clap of your hands. And you managed that on Elan. On Elan? Anyone who can call forth the elements out there won't be stopped by a missing bridge in here. There's always been so much more to you than you've allowed yourself to believe.
She looked him over.
And I can see now that you recognize it too.
The Abyss apparently does that for people. Rinses them clean of any prior foolishness.
You're not a cripple. You aren't weak, helpless, feeble, or pathetic. You are my son, and a power to be reckoned with.
She kissed him. But you must hurry. Bryn left the key in Rel for you, but only for a short time.
She did? Where?
She didn't say exactly, just that it would be somewhere safe and in a place you could find it.
Gifford swallowed hard. I'm sorry we don't have more time. I wish
we'll have eons to be together, but for now, your place is still on Elan.
Gifford frowned. No, I won't be coming back. When I die again, I'll be staying with Roan. I suppose I can visit, but I can't leave her.
Just bring her with you.
She can't get in.
Of course she can, Arya smiled. Reaching out, she took the hand of Gifford's father. Just hold her hand as you enter, and she will be as welcomed as you are. Now go, son. We'll be waiting. Go and continue to make us proud.
Gifford had barely stepped back through the door when Roan embraced him.
You came back, she shouted. You didn't have to come back for me.
It's fine, Roan, he said. My mother got my father into Alison, and I can do the same for you. We'll be together. But we can't go there, not yet.
Gifford!
A voice floated toward them from across the abyss.
Is that Moya? Gifford asked.
Yes, she's over there with Tikchin and Rain. Gifford looked past Roan's shoulder at the three figures on the far side.
Is there any way for you to get across? Moya shouted. We have to get out of here. We need to get to Rel. And the Queen. She's coming.
Gifford looked at the broken bridge.
You are not a cripple.
Gifford saw the door to the White Tower opening. Drums beat and trumpets blared.
Get behind me, Roan.
Moya didn't know what to do. She wasn't sure she could do anything. Something was going on near the door to Alison. Gifford had appeared, and as far as she could tell, he'd come out of the door itself.
Did you see that?
Tekchin asked. Where did he come from? Does that mean he has the key? I thought you said Bryn had it.
That's what Beatrice told me, stupid little princess.
Moya saw the door to the White Tower open.
This isn't good,
Tekchin said, while retreating to the mainland and facing Feral's forces. He put a hand to his sword as he rocked his head and stretched his back.
You can't fight all of them, Moya told him.
Of course I can. I'm a Galantian. I'm not guaranteeing I'll win, but I'll try.
All by yourself?
What are you talking about? You'll help. And I have the Great Rain with me. And he's got that sweet new sword.
Rain looked like he might be sick.
We should tell Gifford and Rhone to go back, Moya said. If they can get into Allison, they'll be safer. We don't need to...
Look!
Rain shouted as he pointed across the abyss. At first, Moya had no idea what she was seeing. Rhone was behind Gifford, who had his hands out as if expecting to catch something. He and Rhone were amazingly bright, illuminating their whole side. Looking at them was like trying to stare at twin stars. But it wasn't their light that had caught Rain's attention.
The stone is moving.
The whole of the bridge and much of the pillar looked to be melting, boiling, swirling, and rising up like a dark and terrible beast.
What's going on? Moya asked. Is it the Queen?
No, Rain said. Run!
Not waiting for her to listen, the dwarf grabbed hold of Moya's wrist and hauled her away from the edge.
What are you doing?
Remember, Perdif,
Rain said as he continued to drag her away. Moya jerked back, but as was always the case with dwarfs, they were a lot stronger than they looked.
What about it?
It's not there anymore.
What are you...
All three were thrown off their feet as an earthquake shook Nifril and stone exploded into the air.
Chapter 27 What do butterflies do?
I thought I had been sent to save Suri, but I left her in danger on the wrong side of the river. As it turned out, I was not supposed to save her at all. I also had not left her in danger. As for the river, the Book of Bryn.
What do butterflies do?
The question had fluttered through Sori's thoughts ever since she left Estramnadon.
Nothing in particular had summoned the idea. There certainly weren't any butterflies around, and no caterpillars either.
Winter had settled in, and the ancient forest was asleep beneath a blanket of snow and ice. Suri was retracing the route she'd travelled in the cage, but she was only faintly aware she'd been there before. Occasionally, she would recognize a tree or a bend in the road, or she'd walk by a village and remember the curious pale frame of an oddly shaped window that looked like a winking eye. All of it was dreamlike, all of it a little bit eerie, because it hadn't been a pleasant dream. The time she had spent in the cage had been a nightmare. Yet even in that screaming white light noise of pure panic, trapped alone in a rolling box, she had learned something. Suri wasn't a placid pond, but a deep well. And in the bottom were those char-white embers, the same ones she had called upon when facing Trilos, the same coals she'd ignited for the first time in the Agave, when she, Mina, bounded, darting into the wood, thrashing through the snow, pausing to sniff at the base of a tree, then under a tuft of dead leaves. She crisscrossed the road, leaving a dotted line of tracks in an almost perfect looping pattern. She hadn't changed. She was still the same carefree wolf she'd always been.
Some soft-spoken part of Suri's mind suggested it wasn't altogether normal for Mina to be alive. This tiny but sensible thought was shouted down.
Is it altogether normal for me to have sacrificed her? Is it altogether normal for Arion to have been killed by Mwandere? Is it altogether normal for milk to turn into butter if you shake it?
Normal, she concluded, was an altogether silly notion. normal was only what usually happened. People didn't usually die, but sometimes they did. People didn't usually come back from death, but obviously that rule turned out to be more flexible than she'd first guessed. Suri had seen a row eaten by a manifestation of the art, which was created by the binding of natural energy held fast by the power of her own grief. In comparison, Mina, bounding through the snow, wasn't strange at all.
Mina isn't her real name.
It was the name Suri had given her when they both were young. Gilarabrin was her true name. That was also the name Trilos knew her by.
But how could Trilos know her at all? How many lives does it take to become the world's wisest wolf?
Maybe wolves are like cats that way. Or maybe death didn't work the way Suri thought, the way Tora had suggested. Suri had never paid death much mind before, but seeing Brynn, or rather seeing Brynn's ghost, made her wonder if being dead wasn't as bad as it sounded.
What exactly was it?
Either way, it was clear Mina had a whole other life that she had never shared with Suri. Probably more than one. Suri didn't begrudge the wolf's mysterious past. The notion only made Mina more interesting, more amazing. But there was a lingering concern.
Mina,
Suri said, and the wolf stopped to look back.
Would you like it better if I called you Gilarabrin?
The wolf whimpered. You like Mina better?
Yep.
The wolf's head jerked up with enough force that her front paws came off the ground. Suri shrugged and smiled.
Mina it is.
The wolf started off again, then stopped when she noticed Suri wasn't following. Suri stood in the road, her arms held tight around her, each breath making little white puffs. The wolf walked back.
Mina,
Suri said, her voice quiet, nearly a whisper that carried clear in the sleeping bedroom of the forest.
Do you forgive me?
The wolf leapt up. Her paws landed on Suri's shoulders. A big tongue washed her face. It was warm and slick.
Okay, okay, she said, laughing. I love you too.
Suri ruffled the fur on Mina's head and scratched behind her ears. But next time, I get to be the sacrifice. Okay. Mina trotted forward again, and Suri didn't think she ever really agreed. The trip to the river had been a long, quiet walk. Suri hadn't met anyone on the road. She was alone with Mina, much the way they used to travel together in the Crescent. In many ways, it felt similar, but not the same. Not the same forest. Not the same Suri or Mina. Things were more difficult back then. Harder to find food. Harder to stay warm. Now Suri had the art. And nothing was difficult. That bothered her.
What do butterflies do?
Caterpillars constantly ate and struggled to crawl, struggled to avoid being eaten. But butterflies never appeared to do anything, never seemed to have any problems at all.